From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, one in 88 kids born today is diagnosed as autistic. But writer Temple Grandin says the label doesn't tell the whole story.
You go out to Silicon Valley, I mean, half the people there are a little bit on the spectrum, and they avoid the labels like the plague. But in order to get services, you got to have the label. And the kids on the real mild end tend to get it because they don't have friends. They're having social problems in school.
Then a post-apocalyptic novel finds hope in human connections and the natural world. We revisit the Battle of Gettysburg on its 150th anniversary. And guitarist Pierre Bensouzan approaches composition with a simple goal.
I try to go from a point of view of what I would like to hear, not what is doable or not doable. What are the sounds, what are the notes that should be there, the chords, the harmony, and then see if it's doable or not.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us. The condition known as autism was not even defined in medicine until 1943. Since then, its prevalence increased steadily through the years until the 1990s, when the numbers suddenly shot up. Today, roughly one out of every 88 children born in the United States is diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. While that might sound like bleak news, Temple Grandin says there's a flip side. Grandin is one of the best-known and accomplished people with autism today. In her new book, The Autistic Brain, Grandin writes that there's a revolution underway in how we view and work with autism. Temple Grandin spoke with Mitch Tyke and explained the advances science has made in understanding the nature of autism.
It is definitely a neurological disorder. It's not psychological. You know, but the problem is the diagnosis has changed over the years. And in my book, The Autistic Brain, Richard Panik and I go over the whole history of the diagnosis. Every decade or so, they changed some of the requirements. It's a behavioral profile of a certain cluster of symptoms, not a precise diagnosis, you know, like tuberculosis would be.
Well, and it was fascinating to see that one of the reasons that some people were diagnosed while others weren't was because of a simple typographical error in the manual.
Well, that's right. You see, and see, the DSM is probably half science, and the other half of it is doctors' opinions sitting around conference room tables.
You write in several places in this latest book about your enthusiasm for taking advantage of imaging studies on your own brain.
Yeah.
Why are you so keen to see inside your brain?
Well, it's sort of like it's been very interesting for me, first of all, learning that my thinking was different. You know, when I was young, I thought everybody was a visual thinker like me. I didn't know I was different until I started interviewing people about how they think. Well, then when I found out that my thinking was different, then, of course, scientists get interested in what's going on inside. You might say exploring, basically.
Well, and it is a fascinating opportunity. How would you compare the usefulness of the imaging technology that's available and employed by scientists today versus the MRI you first underwent in 1987?
Oh, there's been huge advances in the technology compared to the one in 1987. Just huge. Those images done by Walter Snyder at the University of Pittsburgh on the high-definition diffuse intensure imaging can track white fiber bundles that connect up different departments in the brain. Basically, dissect out all the white matter interconnector circuits. And this technology was originally paid for by the Defense Department for head injuries. It has amazing potential for diagnosing autism and many other different things. But it's going to take a lot of subjects put through the scanner in order to do what's called norming the test. At what point is one of those fiber bundles abnormal?
Right, and I think you're right. One of the key challenges is that what is the case in one autistic brain is not necessarily the case in another autistic brain.
Now, the thing that seems to be the most universal, at least on the highly verbal people with autism, are the circuits for social face recognition circuits and circuits for recognizing facial expressions. That seems to be pretty universal in all the people that have good speech. The other stuff, like visual thinking and mathematical thinking and size of the cerebellum, the size of the fear center, like my fear center is bigger than normal, but I want to emphasize that's not on everybody. You see, all those other things are very variable.
Well, what would you think the greatest promise is for the use of these studies? It's one thing to be able to see what's going on and look at what, as you say, a broken brain actually looks like.
Well, it isn't broken because, okay, in a head injury, you rip fiber bundles. You know, a developmental difference, they just grow in a different way. Okay, for example, there's different types of language problems. I had problems with getting my speech out. And there were, the brain scans show that there were problems with the amount of bandwidth I had on the speak-what-you-see circuit. But then another kind of kid, he yaks out all these TV commercials and movie scripts, but he doesn't know what the words mean. You see, that's a different type of a problem. You see, and ultimately, some of those things could be diagnosed when the child's still nonverbal, and you change the way you do therapy for a kid that's echolalic and yaks out TV commercials compared to a kid like me that can't get the speech out.
Would this also have implications for the idea that you write about playing to an autistic person's strengths down the road?
Well, you definitely want to play to their strengths. My strength was art. Strengths often show up around 8 or 9 years old, sometimes earlier, but usually, you know, third grade or so, 8 years old. That's when my ability in art really showed up. You know, that's when ability in math will oftentimes really show up. Build on the kid's area of strength. We got way too much emphasis on deficits. You know, kids that are super good at math often have troubles with reading. You know, and obviously we got to work on reading. If we've got a third grader that's super good at math, I don't want him getting bored with baby math and becoming a behavior problem. No, if that third grader can do a sixth grade math book, then let him have the sixth grade math book. Let him have the college math book if he can do it.
Right. I think you write about your own experience in high school with a particularly remarkable teacher, but the one area that you said did not work out so well was his insistence that you have to get down algebra before you got
that
anything else.
That was a mistake. In fact, what I'm finding now and talking to lots of people is that there's individuals who cannot do algebra that should go right to geometry and right straight to trigonometry. And in my book, The Autistic Brain, I also present the scientific research that shows that the picture thinker like me and the more mathematical thinker actually are two different types of visual spatial thinking. And I've got both brain scan research and research with various paper and pencil tests that prove that these two types of thinking actually do exist. And all those references are in the book.
Well, and it does seem revolutionary, this idea that that the differences between a visual thinker or a picture thinker and a mathematical thinker, you can see by looking physically at shapes and sizes of elements of the brain.
Well, the really, really cool scan is in USA Today. Oh, boy, I wish I had that picture in the book. Walter took a different way of projecting the all those branches that came out of my speak-what-you-see circuit, and it's a massive visual association circuit. When I looked at that in USA Today, I'm going, oh, wow, I wish I had that one in the book. Because the bushes on the one in the book are actually truncated. The ends are cut off.
One of the most interesting sections, I thought, in this book revolves around the idea of sensory problems among people with autism. And first, how do you describe your own sensory problems?
Well, I have problems with touch sensitivity, with scratchy clothes. I had a lot of problems with loud noise. Then you have other individuals that can't stand fluorescent lights because they can see the flicker of fluorescent lights. And in the autistic brain, I go through the different types of sensory problems. I also have some tips on ways to adjust to those problems. But of one area I think there needs to be a lot of research on is the sensory problems, because they can range from being a nuisance to being extremely debilitating. And there are some individuals that will never be able to tolerate a noisy restaurant.
Well, and scientists have known that these sensory problems existed for a while, but why do you think they have been so under-researched or understudied?
Well, I think part of the problem is they are so variable. If you take 10 kids labeled autistic, maybe only 3 of them really have a bad problem with the fluorescent lights. You know, maybe there's 1 or 2 that have a problem with certain smells, but the rest don't. The sensory issues tend to be extremely variable, you know, where things like problems with the face recognition circuits, some of the social circuits, at least in the kids that are verbal, that tends to be pretty much even across the spectrum.
Well, what do you think the strategy ought to be in looking at sensory problems?
Well, you have to figure out what sensory problem the kid has and then try to do something about it. Now, when it comes to sound sensitivity, sometimes a kid can be desensitized if he initiates the sound. All right, let's take the dreaded smoke alarm. Let's take a smoke alarm, wrap it up in five towels. Then he reaches in there and turns it on, where he initiates it. Then you gradually make it louder by taking towels off of it. But when the child controls the initiation of the dreaded sound, it's easier to desensitize.
As you say, I imagine one of the issues is that there is so much variability. You know, when science, when researchers deal with people with headaches, they can say, take a Tylenol or,
That's right.
But there are so many variables from one autistic person to another, it's difficult to come up with
a
blanket.
What needs to be done in terms of researching the sensory problems, and I discussed that in the autistic brain, is we're going to have to research it by the type of sensory problem a person has, because you can get these sensory problems with dyslexia, with ADHD, learning difficulties, tons of different labels, and say, okay, we'll take the people that have a problem with fluorescent lights, and we put them all together as one group, and then we have controls that don't have that problem. And you've got to study them based on what their sensory problem is.
In this book, you write about the mild Asperger types, the people who used to go through life as simply shy or geeky. Are there advantages to having the autism spectrum label, or can it be inhibiting?
I get worried with some of these smart kids with them getting held back, because you go out to Silicon Valley, I mean, half the people there are a little bit on the spectrum, and they avoid the labels like the plague. But in order to get services, you got to have the label. And the kids on the real mild end tend to get it because they don't have friends. They're having social problems in school. And one thing I would strongly recommend is get kids involved with shared interests. You know, if they like horses, how about ride horses? If they like electronics, they could get in a hackerspace electronics club, or be in band, or be in art classes, or cooking classes, or 4-H, or FFA, or Boy Scouts. Get them involved with things where they have a shared interest. And then often the teasing does not happen in those shared interest activities.
Well, what are the other ways that you recommend schools and parents better assist children across the autistic spectrum in preparing them to succeed after they are children?
Well, first of all, autism is a very big spectrum. I mean, at one end of it, you've got Einstein, who had no language until age 3. And at the other end, you've got somebody that remains nonverbal and is going to have to live in a supervised living situation. And the problem is they're all called autism. And I think it's oftentimes hard for teachers to shift gears between, you know, a kid that, you know, ought to be trained to be a scientist versus a kid that will have to live in a group home. You know, it's a very, very big spectrum.
Well, yours is a remarkable story, and the book is remarkable as well. And Temple Grandin, I thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Well, it's great to be here, and I hope you all read The Autistic Brain.
Temple Grandin is a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She also lives with an autism spectrum disorder and has written several best-selling books on the subject. Her new book, written with Richard Panik, is called The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. There's a link to more about it from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Peter Heller's first novel explores a post-apocalyptic world that is both terrifying and quite beautiful. We'll hear about the dog stars when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic fiction tends to be rather bleak. The world as we know it has ended. Chaos rules, and humans, or what's left of them, tend to be reduced to their basest natures. Survival is paramount, and all the niceties of so-called civilization tend to go by the wayside. But what happens a few years after the apocalyptic event, when a new normal has settled in? How do the survivors fare? What do their lives look like? How do they define and reimagine their humanity? The Dog Stars is Peter Heller's exploration of a world laid waste by a superflu. Heller is an award-winning adventure writer who has traveled the world as an expedition kayaker. He's written for numerous magazines and has published 4 books of nonfiction detailing some of those adventures. But The Dog Stars is his first novel. Peter Heller was in Milwaukee last month to read from it at Boswell Books, and he stopped by the Lake Effect studio then to chat with me. Peter, welcome to Lake Effect. It is a pleasure to have you here.
It's great to be here.
The Dog Stars, this is your first novel. Most of your previous books already read like Boy's Own Adventures. You know, you're going into places that most of us don't even realize exist, let alone that you can actually have an adventure there, so much beyond the scope of most of our everyday experiences. So what was it that you wanted to explore writing a novel that you couldn't already explore in doing the nonfiction writing?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I've been wanting to write a novel ever since I was like 11. Ever since Annie Bosworth, my librarian in my school, handed me In Our Time by Hemingway, I read that book. I was in New York City. I read about the Big Two-Hearted River, parts one and two, and I wanted to do that. I wanted to hop off a freight up in, you know, northern Michigan and walk through grass and have it wet my pant legs and camp and burn my tongue on cowboy coffee and fish the most beautiful river on earth. And, you know, break up with a girl that was too good for me, who could row and fish. I never understood why he did that. I wanted that all my life was to write like this guy, you know. And then as I read more and more fiction, I mean, then I had other mentors and idols. And I was always attracted to poetry as well. And I loved the most musical sort of fiction writers, you know, the sort of the In the House of Faulkner, the guys who wrote like they were, you know, they were prose poems. I just wanted to do that. And when I got out of college, no one had ever told me you couldn't make a living being a poet. I thought it was mean of them. So I was a kayaker. I just started writing for outdoor magazines because that's what I knew. I mean, I knew how to, you know, paddle. I was doing extreme kayaking. So I got sort of pleasantly diverted away from the initial passion for literature, writing for magazines. And all my other nonfiction books, they came out of those stories that I wrote for magazines. So one thing followed another. But a couple of years ago, it's just 2 years ago now, I had about 9 months out ahead of me, I figured, where I didn't have to take an assignment. And I thought, you know, it's time. I want to do what I've wanted to do my whole life. And I sat down and, you know, it was like coming home. That's what it felt like. It was so thrilling. And I felt like at last I could take, you know, the one hand that had been tied behind my back and go full bore with all cylinders and just write this thing I've always wanted to write. I didn't want to know what was going to happen. I mean, in all my other stories, because they were nonfiction, I always knew what the ending was going to be. I knew what was going to happen next because they happen. I didn't want to know this time. I wanted to be surprised the way you are in a river when you come around the corner and it could be a pool or a waterfall or, you know what, 10 guys with spears, you know. I wanted that thrill. And so I started with the first line and had no clue and just let it rip.
Fishing outdoors, spending time in the outdoors and not knowing what's coming around the bend really play huge roles in this novel. It is post-apocalyptic, but that is just sort of the backdrop of this one man's relationship with his natural world in a lot of ways. I mean, is Higgs sort of part of you and what you might imagine you might be if you were in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I hope I would be as formidable as Higgs. I mean, he's, you know, I mean, he's interesting because he was a poet, you know, and he had to be a contractor. So there's parallels, you know. You know, he ends up being pretty good at that, you know, pretty good at defending himself.
But he doesn't think he is initially.
But he doesn't like it. He hates it. You know, he doesn't even like to kill the trout that he eats. And I don't either. I love to fish. I hate that part where you have to knock it against a rock, you know. I hunt also. I hate that one moment where you have to kill the thing. And Higgs is like that too. I mean, so there are a lot of Higgs loves a lot of the things that I love, and he shies away from a lot of the stuff that I shy away from. And so in that way, he's sort of a doppelganger. He is happiest in nature. He's most connected in nature. He loves his dog. So me too.
Yeah. And the dog, Jasper, I mean, this is also a novel about relationships and connection, whether you have the connection and want it or don't want it, which also plays a key role, too. But the one he does want very much is the one with Jasper. And Jasper is such an endearing character. And he's the dog.
He's the dog. He's some people's favorite character. You know, I get emails all the time about Jasper. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I had all dogs growing up, and I had dogs, you know, at different parts of my life. And I don't have one now because I travel so much, and it just wouldn't be fair. So I have a cat. But Jasper sort of was an amalgam of, you know, all the great dogs that I loved.
And again, it's that relationship that he has –
with Higg and that Higg has with him that explores – it's a very elemental relationship that we have with dogs.
Yeah, and it keeps – okay, so Higg is a guy that's lost everything. I mean, you know, he lost his wife. She was pregnant with their first child. He lost all his friends, all his family. I mean, this is a guy who's lost everything. He has his dog, Jasper, and Jasper keeps him connected to his humanity. I mean, you know, Higg's whole challenge in this post-apocalyptic world is how to stay connected with the things that he loves and not just become overwhelmed by despair. And he's heavily traumatized also, as you would be. So Jasper's a big part of that. When he's with Jasper, he stays connected to something that he really loves. When he's in nature, when he's fishing, he stays connected to something that he's loved his whole life. And, you know, the stars, I think, of the dog stars represent that for him too. You know, when he and Jasper sleep out every night. He tried sleeping in one of the houses that was by the airport, but it made him too sad. If he and Jasper can sleep out under the stars every night and he makes up constellations, he said he had a book on the stars, now he doesn't. So he just makes up, you know, a bear and a goat maybe where they're not supposed to be. And he makes them for the animals that have gone extinct and one for his wife, one for Jasper. It's a way of staying connected to things he loves and reinventing this world in this new reality. And he sleeps out because he feels like maybe he can pretend that one day they could just pack up everything and go home. It's provisional. It feels temporary.
But then you have Bangley.
Yeah.
And Bangley is almost like looking in the mirror and seeing the person you don't want to see.
Yeah.
You know, but I also really love Bangley.
I love Bangley too, oddly. I mean, Bangley's just a mean SOB. I mean, he is really good at one thing, which is, you know, killing people from long range, you know. He shoots first, asks questions later. He is all about survival. He is the ultimate survivalist. And he's one of those guys. I mean, I think a lot of us know people like this who would have been very disappointed if the apocalypse hadn't come. You know, he's sort of been waiting his whole life for this, and he's really good at it. And, you know, thank goodness for Higg, because they have this sort of odd couple relationship, and Bangley really protects Higg in many ways.
And I was going to say that they end up overlapping somewhat, their personalities, and they influence each other in ways I think that they don't expect that they're going to.
I think that's true. I think Bangley, by the end of the book, I mean – by the end of the book, Bangley is a human being. And he wouldn't have been that without that relationship with Higg. I mean, he realizes that Higg has become family. And it's very moving to me. I mean, you know, I just wrote the book. And because I started with the first line and wrote into it, all of this stuff was a surprise for me. And it was, you know, it was wonderful to see how those guys evolved.
Right. And they certainly did. And yeah. And watching that evolution was fascinating. At one point, without giving anything away in the book, there's a point at which Higg makes a decision that basically changes his world, changes right. Bangley's world, changes the world as they know it. I was trying to figure out exactly how to ask this question.
You know, like, I think we can talk about it because it's sort of like it's on the back flap, you know, and it's sort of like the one thing I knew that was going to happen. Like I knew a couple of things. One is I knew that Higg, partway through the book, halfway through probably, was going to have to leave this little airport in the country that's on the plains off the mountain front in Colorado, get in his little Cessna. I mean, what he still has left is this old 1956 Cessna 182 that he flies every day on a patrol looking for survivors and intruders. With Jasper, Dog is my co-pilot. They fly together every day. And I knew that he was going to get in his old Cessna and fly out across the mountains looking for human connection. And I knew that he was going to fly past his point of no return, which is that point at which you don't have enough fuel to get back. You've flown too far. I knew for dramatic reasons that was going to happen. And I also had this idea that he was going to meet – there's a transmission that's very early on in the book. They talk about it on the back flap. He gets this sort of broken transmission from Western Colorado. I knew he was going to go looking for those people.
But it's the choice that interests me and how it leads up to that. It's like he gets to a point, I think, where he has to do it. And I think we all get to that point at some point in our lives where you're looking at the unknown and you choose to go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think those are the most important parts of, you know, places in our lives where we get way out of our comfort zone and go into that unknown. T.S. Eliot has this poem that I just love called The Four Quartets where he talks about that. You know that poem. To arrive at a place, something about where we have not been, we have to go through a place in which we are not. And it's sort of like that feeling of, you sort of obliterate your old self when you make a big decision like that and take a huge risk and you emerge as something new. And it's, you know, the most exciting times of our lives are like that. Whether it's, you know, we pop the question and get married.
Or decide to write a novel.
Or decide to write a novel or, you know, take that leap off of whatever, you know. And so it's a big deal for Higg, and it works out well dramatically in the book. And for me, I had no idea what he was going to discover when he took that leap, and it was really, really fun for me to see what happened.
I'm curious about that process for you of literally not knowing where you were going to go. Did you find yourself being dictated to? Did you just kind of leave yourself open and say, let's just see what comes out?
Yeah, it's a funny dance. So one of my best friends from high school was the producer of Lost, the TV show. He was the executive producer and the showrunner. So he ran the writers and, you know, he was responsible for the ending. You might not like it. Anyway, I called him up because I knew he would know about structure. And I said, hey, Carlton, do you know any novelists who start with the first line and have no clue? And he said, oh, yeah, I've worked with Stephen King. And he often starts with the first line and just writes into the story. You know, that suggests a voice and then a place and a situation. And before you know it, you've got a story going. And then Elmore Leonard, which really surprised me. I mean, here's these tightly plotted crime novels in South Florida. I figure with Elmore Leonard and probably with Stephen King, too, at some point they must step back and plot because, you know, they're so tight. But it sort of gave me permission to work like that. So, you know, I wrote into it, and it's a funny sort of dance. I mean, in some ways it was like Higg was just sitting across the campfire one evening in the, you know, in a windy fire by a creek telling me this is what happened to me, you know, a few years ago. And so in that way it was really moving. I would just listen to this voice. But in other ways, it's like sort of riding a spirited horse. There's a dance there because it's not just like I'm hearing a voice. I have my writer's instincts too. And so you're riding the narrative, that spirited horse, and you get to a fork and the horse maybe wants to go down into that gully, that trail. And you're kind of know as a writer, you know, you've been there before and it didn't really – it's not a good place to go. We're going to take a right and we're going to go up into these woods and those meadows, you know. And it's sort of like that constant dance where you're sort of listening to the voice and you're kind of just – you're also nudging it a little bit. Very hard to describe, you know, what that feels like. But I have to tell you, I write in a coffee shop. I was often laughing out loud. Sometimes I'd be like crying and I have tears dripping off my cheek. And I know that people were looking at me going, hey, man, that guy's going through a bad divorce or something, you know, or, you know, somebody just died.
Yeah, somebody give him a coffee.
Yeah.
Give him a Danish. He'll feel better.
Yeah.
Peter Heller, it has been such a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for coming in.
It's been great. Thank you so much.
Peter Heller is the author of The Dog Stars, his first novel, which is just out in paperback. Heller is a contributing editor at Outside Magazine, Men's Journal, and National Geographic Adventure. In addition, he's an award-winning adventure writer and the author of four books of literary nonfiction. He lives in Denver. Heller was in Milwaukee last month on a book tour, and he spoke with us then. 150 years ago today, the Battle of Gettysburg began. We'll commemorate the battle that is often described as the turning point in the American Civil War next, when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company. 150 years ago today, one of the fiercest and most important battles of the American Civil War began. The Battle of Gettysburg lasted 3 days and was the deadliest battle of the Civil War. It was also a turning point for the Union forces. Wisconsinites saw action in many of the American Civil War's fiercest battles, including Gettysburg. 6 infantry regiments were there 150 years ago, including those in the Iron Brigade and a company of sharpshooters. We'll hear their stories tomorrow. Today, historian Thomas Martin Sobotky takes us back to July 1, 1863, and sets the scene for the first day of battle.
The Confederate Army mainly was on a huge foraging operation to get the war out of Virginia that had been so ravaged by the war. Lee felt, and I think his whole army felt, that one more big victory over this Eastern Union Army, the Army of the Potomac, that they had beaten so much at Fredericksburg the previous December, and they'd beaten them at Chancellorsville. And they'd beaten them in the summer of 62 at Second Manassas or Second Bull Run. Frankly, the average Confederate soldier in Robert E. Lee's army had no respect whatsoever for their opponents in the Army of the Potomac, none. And Lee himself felt that these men could do anything. After the battle, when it was lost, Lee said that I thought my men were invincible. So I see the Battle of Gettysburg just like the Iliad or the Odyssey. This is like a Greek tragedy. It's the immensity of the story is interesting historically. You have 2,400 people in the town of Gettysburg, and here come 150,000 soldiers who occupy their town and the immediate area around it for 3 days and longer, and there are 53,000 casualties. It is the largest battle ever fought on the North American continent.
What were the stakes at this point in the war?
On the Union side, the stakes could not be higher. Quite frankly, if you study the Army of the Potomac, if they had lost that battle at Gettysburg, that army could have easily disintegrated and not been an effective break on whatever Robert E. Lee would want to do. In fact, a lot of the Confederates felt that if they beat the Army of the Potomac badly enough up in Pennsylvania somewhere, they didn't know it was going to be Gettysburg, that they might be able to go and take Philadelphia and Baltimore and Washington and force an end to the war and get Confederate independence. And I'm not so sure they were wrong.
Obviously, you have these two massive armies meeting up in this one small little area. But what actually was the spark that began these 3 days of battle, terrible battle?
Well, it was the meeting of some Union cavalry under General John Buford, who is way underrated, I think, because he dies in early 1863 because of all the wounds he's had in previous battles. He really was the best cavalryman the Union had, east or west. He took his orders from a wing of George Gordon Meade's Army of the Potomac under John Reynolds and was out west of Gettysburg, essentially in a what's called picket duty, where they were vedettes. They were out there to make contact with the Confederate Army, try to assess the strength of it, direction, either coming in from the north or east or the west, which would be the case. And a small cavalry fight with the lead elements of Confederate infantry under Lee's Army of Northern Virginia just kept growing and growing. It's a meeting engagement, and that's what military officers would call it, where two armies blunder into each other and both sides feed in reinforcements. And before either side knows it, they've got a huge battle on their hands. And to disengage is very difficult to do.
Did either army really have a sense? Were they really prepared for this battle as it unfolded?
Neither army had, you know, a specific plan, but I think that's really what's so high stakes is the rebels have this feeling that they're going to have an easy victory over this particular Union army. They are very, very confident. Lee's army, despite the loss of General Jackson Stonewall a month before at Chancellorsville, has never been in better shape. They've never been so confident. They've never been so well equipped. The Union army knows it's a good army. The average officers and enlisted men know that. Even their new commander, George Meade, knows that. But somehow or another, they've always lost. And they're at a point where they have to win a victory if they can have any faith in their ability to beat their opponent, the Army of Northern Virginia under Robert E. Lee. So this is a crucial battle for this Eastern Union Army. And what really makes the stakes so incredibly high is that Washington, D.C. isn't that far away. But I really think that the Union side, it was more critical that they win that battle.
Was it because the stakes were so high that the battle went on so fiercely for 3 days and there were so many casualties? Or was it really that we had two equally talented armies stacked up against each other and just going all out?
I think what you just said is really the truth of it. The Army of the Potomac was actually a few thousand men stronger. I think Meade, the new commander, had about 80 to 85,000 effective troops. Lee, believe it or not, had 75,000 men and good men. Meade saw that he had after the first day's fight, which frankly Meade did not want to fight at Gettysburg. He wanted to have the line further back at Pipe Creek. But he saw the high ground that John Reynolds and the men of the Iron Brigade from Wisconsin had done so much to make sure they held. And he realized as an engineer, Meade had been particularly in the engineer corps out of West Point for many years, and he could take one look at that ridge on Cemetery Ridge, those hills that are so well known, Cemetery Hill and Culp's Hill, the two conical hills at the other end, Big and Little Round Top, and see that this was a hell of a defensive position. And that once his army was there, he might as well just reinforce it and stand at Gettysburg. Robert E. Lee, and this is where the hubris comes in, was determined to win this battle, felt that it was almost a given that his army must be destined to win this battle. And Lee was a fighter that once he got in the middle of a fight, a lot of his contemporaries around him, the generals and the officers that served this very fine commander, said that once his blood was up, you just couldn't stop him. And here's where the hubris comes in. There are a lot of people who are trying to stop Lee from making this a 2- and 3-day fight, but he cannot stop himself. He figures that in each day, they won the first day's fighting July 1st by pushing the Union through the town and up onto these hills. And on July 2nd, there was desperate fighting on either end of the line. And quite frankly, if we had the time, the Union was right on the edge of the abyss for defeat, but they held on. Both sides fought this battle with an intensity that was unusual for many of the battles in this war. It's as if both sides, as if God had bequeathed to these soldiers, hundreds of thousands of them, the knowledge that this was it. You know, we all have that in life where it's like, this is it. It's that moment that's going to change everything. And it's the soldiers themselves that seem to have that knowledge. And they fought like demons on both sides. The Union had – that army, the Army of the Potomac, had never fought better. One Confederate said, seems like those fellers up north shoot straighter when they're in their own country. And Lee's men had never done better in the offensive attacks they made at Gettysburg, even though they fell just short. And then, of course, the third day, which is almost an anticlimax, however desperate it was for the men on the spot, is Pickett's charge. But that's what this is like, a 3-day Greek tragedy with hubris present, with everything at stake. General Meade was not a great offensive general, but the guy was an old engineering officer who knew how to place an army in a good position, and he did what he needed to do. And Lee was overconfident and overextended himself in a very key battle with high stakes. For the Union side, victory meant a lot of confidence that that army needed. And the prevention of Lee from taking Philadelphia, from taking Harrisburg, the Pennsylvania capital, Baltimore, or even Washington. I think for the Confederates, while this was not as decisive a defeat as traditional history tells us in our school days back in school, the one Confederate Virginia infantry veteran of Pickett's charge said, and I think it sums it all up, "We gained nothing but glory and lost our best men." What was lost by the Confederate Army under Lee at Gettysburg was that offensive edge that gave them the edge over those Eastern Union armies. They lost that at Gettysburg. They would turn out to be still a very fine army, but their ability to take it to the Union side like they had in the previous years of the war was lost because they lost so many good lieutenants, captains, majors, colonels, even generals that you can't replace those guys. You just can't.
Thanks, Thomas.
You're welcome.
Thomas Martin Sabatke is the voice of our Civil War series, Iron Brigade and Beyond. He's a historian, teacher, and the author of the novel Richmond's Bloody Road under the name Thomas Martin Saturday. He's also the author of Across That Dark River, The Civil War Memory. We'll take a short break and then chat with a remarkable French Algerian guitarist who performed at UWM earlier this year. Lake Effect returns with Pierre Bensouzan in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Virtuosic guitarist Pierre Bensouzan almost ended up a piano player. He started his formal music study in the piano at the age of 7, not long after his family moved from his native Algeria to Paris. 10 years later, he signed his first recording contract on the guitar. Today, the Los Angeles Times describes Bensouzan as, quote, one of the most unique and brilliant acoustic guitar veterans in the world music scene today, unquote. His music draws on his Algerian, French, and Jewish heritages, as well as a variety of folk traditions from around the world. Bensouzan was in Milwaukee earlier this year, teaching, lecturing, and performing. He stopped by our studios to chat with me then and explained that becoming a guitarist wasn't ever in the plan.
In fact, it was a coincidence, an accident. I was on my way to be a pianist, and my teacher went away. She abandoned me. And I really felt like abandoned, like orphan. And I stopped playing. I tried another teacher, two other teachers, and the chemistry was just not there. So I felt there was no need for me to play the piano anymore. It's strange, huh? And so my father was the entity to suggest music in my life. Not by saying play music, but just by making it available to me. He was listening to swing, to Django, Benny Goodman, opera, tango. So all that music was always there, especially on weekends when he was not working. And it was not like, oh, you have to play. It was like, do what you want. And so I played all the time. And because he loved Django so much, he got me a guitar. When he saw the piano was not going to be in my life, at least for that time, he got me a guitar, just in case. And I ended up teaching myself how to play the guitar because music had to come out. Music was sort of saying to me, hey, Pierre, no. We like you. You need to let it go through you. So, and that's exactly what happened with the guitar. I didn't like the guitar at all.
Why not?
Because it was not talking to me. The piano is so logic. It goes up, down, you have two hands, you sit, you look at it, and you create chords and counterpoint, and you discover the compositions of other people in a very unique way. It's like reading a book and entering in the mind of a writer. Same thing with the piano. I could really go into Beethoven or Schumann and Mozart or Bach and feel totally overwhelmed by those guys. Like, oh my God, how can someone write such beautiful music? But that, in fact, without me knowing about it, it sort of told me something about music from inside, the way it's made. Not a recipe, but just a sort of inspiration to see music from within. And so when I went to the guitar, I think I took that luggage with me somehow. It never left me. And then gradually the guitar started to become a piano for me. I needed to go back to the piano. But of course I had lost by then all my shops and the relationship with that instrument. So the guitar became my new best friend.
I love the idea of that it becoming a piano for you. I have a similar experience. I started out as a pianist as well, and I'm just now learning the guitar. Mm-hmm. And I find the same problem, mm-hmm, that the logic, that the way the piano works and the way I experience music, it's hard to translate it to the guitar for me right now. And so you had to actually take it and make it.
Mm. It's doable. A lot of composers out there have been writing for guitar, and some are guitar players themselves, like Berlioz was a guitar player. Villa-Lobos was a concert piano player, but he worked with guitar players. Piazzolla worked with Roberto Ossel to compose his pieces for guitar. Sometimes they need to work with a guitar player to find out what can be done and what cannot be done. When I approach composition, I try to go from a point of view of what I would like to hear, not what is doable or not doable. First of all, just what are the sounds, what are the notes that should be there, the chords, the harmony, and then see if it's doable or not, and try everything I can to make it work.
And you also use a specific tuning on the guitar,
yeah,
that a lot of people in Celtic music use and in other genres of music, but it's one that you stick with rather than the more standard tuning.
In fact, I started with – I'm self-taught, so I didn't spend much time with a standard tuning, although I did, you know, chords and singing and doing a lot of folk music and stuff. But I was attracted to open tunings, to experiment with tunings at a very early stage. And so I was going from one tuning to another tuning. And after a while, I started to feel sort of piano attitude again. Like in piano, there is no tuning. There is just a keyboard. And you deal with what you have. And I thought, okay, I'm going to maybe stick to one tuning and learn my fretboard this way and forget that I want to have an immediate result with that tuning, because sometimes we go to different tunings in order to capture something unique, not necessary feeling that we have to master that tuning. I mean, not that we do master anything, but that, you know, we try to be able to improvise, to know chords, scales, modes, know the notes, know the fretboard in that tuning. So very often we don't really deepen the tuning, we just stay on the surface of it. And I decided to not stay on the surface of the tuning I use, which is D80, G80, Dadgad, and to really make it like a standard tuning, you know, like what jazz guys, classical, flamenco, Brazilian musicians, when they play the guitar, they play in standard tuning, they really deepen the tuning, and I did the same with Dadgad. Everything had to be played in Dadgad, whatever it took. A lot of stretchings.
Yes, you know, I imagine.
A lot of stretching because strings are tuned down, so you need to make it up. That space that you lose needs to be compromised with better flexibility. And because I came from the piano, that really helped me. My fingers were totally ready for that. That's another thing the piano helped, agility.
It's also when you're in an open tuning like Dadgad, there is that openness, and it feels like, at least as a listener, that there's space,
yeah,
to move around in there. Mm. Does that make sense?
It does totally make sense. And then you need to present another side of music, which is sometimes there is no space. You need to work with contrasts and oppositions. So the problem with open tunings, I find, is that it's too emphatic, too vibrant, too well-resonant, too much information sometimes, and too much sound kills the sound. You need to create a perspective so that the ear goes through a different experience. And so you need to give the information of space, of sustain, of long resonances, and also something much more intimate. When you speak to the ear, you whisper. And when you whisper, the sounds are very short. They have a different quality. And so then it's another way to enter into playing open tunings, which is that you need to control the sound and the longevity of notes, which technically speaking is a very different approach.
Now, you grew up, or at least were born, in Algeria, and you mentioned Arabic music and, of course, Indian music as well, where there are all kinds of other harmonies and tones and quarter tones and different rhythms. All of that I hear in your music. At least as you talk about a flavor, a taste, there might be a little bit of a spice of that thrown in. Do you consciously use all of those things, or do they just sort of percolate through you as you're composing? And
both. In fact, mostly the second option that you quote. I feel that things happen through me, and I try to control as much as I can. But sometimes I have no idea what's going on. I understand musically what's happening, what I could do musically. But why is that thing coming to me in the first place? I have no idea. It's just there. So I don't try to explain it or justify it, or I try to not waste it and to do something interesting with it. And yet it's a good balance between letting the spontaneity taking place and not penalize it by trying to be too sophisticated or too intellectual about it, and yet develop it into an art form where you try to give a direction to it, to try to control a little bit on the perception that one might have when listening to it, and also as a player to make it doable so that it's enjoyable to play and not a torture. And a lot of things are difficult to play because I try to play what I hear, not what I know. So a lot of the things I write, I have to learn them. They are, of course, in my system, but sometimes, technically speaking, it's very challenging. And so I need to come up to that level of expertise, which I don't necessarily have. This is how I've improved my technique over the years, by just having the guitar to really capture something which had nothing to do with the guitar. It was just an instrument for me. And so I try, as a guitar player, to stay away from guitar talks, from the things that fingers, you know, the finger things, that very self-indulgent kind of thing, which means nothing musically most of the time. But one can be trapped into a technical ease and forget the very sake of music, which sometimes is very easy to play. Something very easy to play can sound beautiful. And that's exactly what I want to do. I would like to always, always be in a musical content and not in anything else.
Pierre, I want to thank you for stopping by.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you.
Guitar virtuoso Pierre Bensouzan was in Milwaukee earlier this year to teach and perform at the Peck School of the Arts Recital Hall on the campus of UW-Milwaukee. We talked with him then. There's more information about him at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.